This is VOA News. I'm Faith Lapidus. U.S. President Donald Trump and his national security advisor are publicly at odds about the seriousness of the threat currently posed by North Korea. In a Sunday morning tweet from Tokyo, Trump issued a retort to John Bolton, who the previous day had told reporters that there was no doubt North Korea's recent test firing of short-range ballistic missiles violated a U.N. resolution. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders told NBC News Trump is not concerned and remains convinced that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will move toward denuclearization.
Some of the activity that's taken place, as you can see from the president's Twitter, isn't something that's bothering the president. He still feels good about the relationship that he has and about Chairman Kim's commitment that he made to the president.
However, senior White House officials traveling with the president acknowledged his tweet caused confusion and consternation, not only within the administration, but also among America's allies in the region. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, a Trump ally, predicted Sunday that if opposition Democrats in the House of Representatives try to impeach him, the president will be reelected next year and Republicans will retake control of the House. However, freshman Democratic Representative Rashida Tlaib told NBC News that Congress would benefit if President Trump were impeached.
We can't do our job if the president thinks he's above the law, thinks that he cannot abide by what the United States Congress is passing through and asking and demanding of him. I got to tell you, from the wall to the children at the border to immigration reform to everything, we can't be able to do our jobs if we don't hold him accountable.
About three dozen Democrats and a lone Republican in the House have called for impeachment hearings to start. This is VOA News. An Iraqi court has sentenced three French citizens to death after finding them guilty for joining the Islamic State group. They are the first French IS members to receive death sentences in Iraq. The hearings push forward the trials of hundreds of people, many of them foreigners, captured by U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces after the militant group lost its final stronghold in Syria last year. Last Monday, another French man and a German woman were sentenced to life in prison in Iraq for belonging to IS. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told journalists during a 48-hour visit to Baghdad that Iran would respond to what he called aggressive actions by the U.S., both economic and military, but it continues to adhere to the 2015 nuclear accord. Iraqi Foreign Minister Mohammad Ali Hakim insisted Baghdad opposes U.S. sanctions against Tehran, but would be ready to act as an intermediary between both parties at the right moment. Delegations from Venezuela's government and the opposition have returned to Norway to try to resolve the South American country's political crisis. The Norwegian government says it will mediate the talks this week. Opposition leader Juan Guaido is recognized by the United States and about 50 other countries as Venezuela's legitimate leader. He has not, however, been able to oust Nicolas Maduro from office. Thousands of detainees throughout Turkey's prison system ended their hunger strike Sunday that had been mounted to force Turkey to end jailed militant leader Abdullah Öcalan's isolation at İmralı Island Prison. Earlier Sunday, Öcalan's lawyers read a statement from their client calling for an end to the strikes. Twice this month, Turkey allowed the 70-year-old leader of the outlawed PKK to meet with his lawyers after an 8-year hiatus. President Trump has tweeted that the hundreds of thousands of Rolling Thunder motorcycle riders will be back next year to participate in Washington's Memorial Day observance, even though organizers said this Sunday this would be the last ride. Executive Director Artie Muller said he'd grown frustrated dealing with the Pentagon in coordinating the annual Ride for Freedom, and the 2019 event would mark the beginning of a new chapter in their history.
We're not really talking about a legacy here because we're not going away. We're just spreading out, and we hope to get stronger. That's what our idea is on this. So, coast to coast, north, south, Midwest.
Mueller had no immediate response to Trump's tweet. Rolling Thunder's Ride for Freedom was designed to raise awareness of service people who've given their lives during U.S. military combat or are still missing in action. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
In view of the chaos that has ensued under the watch of the Electoral Commission, I'm calling upon the Electoral Commission for the nullification of the aggregated vote under the tripartite elections of 21st May 2019. This country must regroup and prepare for credible elections to the satisfaction of the people of this country.
The Malawian main opposition party challenges some portions of the presidential election results.
The election was well prepared and the campaign was competitive, voting went well, but now there's problems and there's some sort of complaints that the Election Commission is having to resolve. What we try to do is look at all the stages and all the elements and offer an assessment of where they went well and where they ran into problems.
The European Union Poll Observer Mission releases its preliminary findings about the just-ended Malawi general election.
For anybody, no matter how highly placed or any group to actually say that this is colonization, that the government has a policy of colonization and transition of the diaspora, it's grossly unfair.
And former Nigerian President Chief Olusegun Obasanjo comes under criticisms from the administration in Abuja. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian High Court has ordered the Electoral Commission not to announce presidential results until ballots from a third of the voting districts have been recounted after complaints of vote rigging. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
A count of votes tallied in three quarters of the country's polling stations released on Thursday found incumbent President Peter Mutharika leading with 40.9% of the vote. Opposition candidate Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party had 35.4% of the vote, while Vice President Saulos Chilima was at 18%. The High Court injunction was obtained by Chakwera amid scores of complaints filed with the Commission by various parties over the election process. Chakwera on Wednesday warned of alleged attempts to rig the vote, saying his party had conducted its own count, and this, he claimed, showed he was ahead. The Electoral Commission, which has to announce the final results within 8 days of voting, had on Friday suspended updating the tallies from the May 21 vote in order to resolve the complaints. Speaking at the press conference Saturday, Commission Chairperson Jenny Ansah said although the commission has looked into the complaints, she could not continue announcing the final results.
I wish to inform you that the commission has been served with an injunction restraining us from proceeding with announcement of presidential results. The commission will wait for this process to be concluded before announcing the results.
But the commission did announce the parliamentary results for the 192 constituencies. The ruling DPP has gained 62 seats, while MCP secured 55 seats. Ezinhoa Nkaka is the Secretary General for the MCP. He told VOA the injunction is aimed at paving the way for the commission to address voting anomalies,
which included use of an official paper, which included tipexing of results, which included no signing of the results by monitors or one person just writing names on behalf of the monitors, and so many more irregularities.
Candidate Chilima, who heads the United Transformation Movement Party, told reporters in the capital Lilongwe Saturday that the Malawi Electoral Commission should nullify the elections because vote counting had been fraudulent all across the country.
In view of the chaos that has ensued under the watch of the Electoral Commission, I'm calling upon the Electoral Commission for the nullification of the aggregated vote under the tripartite elections of 21st May 2019. This country must regroup and prepare for credible elections to the satisfaction of the people of this country. We should not allow fraudsters to continue holding this country at ransom.
Just less than three-quarters of the 6.8 million people who registered to vote actually cast ballots, the commission's answer said. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Meanwhile, the European Union Poll Observation Mission has released its preliminary findings about the just-ended Malawi general election. The observer group said the Malawi Electoral Commission administered the vote in well-managed, inclusive, transparent and competitive elections. It, however, said the political party campaigns leading up to the polls were marked by tensions and an unlevel playing field. For more about the European Union's poll observation findings, I reached the group's deputy chief observer, Mark Stevens.
We made a number of key findings, really. On the election preparations leading up to the election commission had undertaken a number of very positive changes to how they organised the election, including an improved voter registration. And they also put in place a lot of the logistical framework for the election. And they acted in a very sort of inclusive and transparent way with stakeholders, regularly updating them. And, for example, political parties were in Dubai with the election commission following the printing of the ballot papers and things like that. On the election campaign side, it was a very robust, competitive election. I mean, lots of candidates, seven presidentials, and then we had thousands of the parliamentary candidates and for the local council elections. So it was a very sort of competitive, active election campaign. Our biggest problem with the election campaign was probably the unlevel playing field. So I'm talking about misuse of incumbency, abuse of state resources, and bias in the state media. These are problems which have recurred in all the previous elections in Malawi, where the EU has observed. And they're obviously still a problem for this election as well.
You've been meeting some of the stakeholders and political parties during this period. What has been the overarching observation from your standpoint?
The election was well prepared and the campaign was competitive. Voting went well. But now there's problems and there's some sort of complaints that the election commission is having to resolve. What we try to do is look at all the stages and all the elements and offer an assessment of where they went well and where they ran into problems. And that's with a view to hopefully offering some ideas for the future of how the problems which, you know, the election faces can be resolved for the future. So that's more the way we approach our observation.
Dr. Jane Ansah, the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, told me recently that she has ensured or implemented measures to engage all these political parties and other stakeholders to address their concerns. Let me ask you this. How is the Electoral Commission handling these concerns these political parties present to them?
Yeah, my understanding of the process is that for these elections, MEC created like a legal department, which is a new formulation. And the legal department receives the complaint. And they are, although they may be lodged at local levels, they're ultimately centralized at the national level. And MEC, as the, I think, the legal department in of course, coordination with the commission itself, the chair and the other commissioners, will then look at those complaints and make a determination on their view of those complaints. We don't have access to what those complaints are, though we have seen some sort of outline, and they vary quite a lot, really. But I know the main opposition party is also raising some concerns because it's lodged a court case where they claim there are some problems with the results in some districts, and they're urging MEC to look at that. So I think, as you characterised, it is correct. The chair of the Election Commission put all this on the table. She shared all this information with the political party, which I think they very much appreciate it. And now they're just, you know, they will all want to see what the MEC's final determination on these complaints is and what the implications are for the announcement of the result.
Mark Stevens is the Deputy Chief Observer of the European Union's poll mission. He spoke with me from Blantyre. Former Nigerian President Chief Olusegun Obasanjo is coming under criticism from the administration in Abuja. The criticism came after the former president recently stated that the ongoing insecurity challenges the country faces is now West African Fulanization, African Islamization, and global organized crimes. The former president was backed by some Christian officials who say it appears the violence carried out by Boko Haram and other terrorist groups forms part of the plan to turn Nigeria Nigeria into an Islamic state, an accusation the Nigerian government sharply denies. For more about the administration's reaction, I reached Nigerian Information Minister Lai Mohammed in the capital, Abuja.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, the person who championed that cause was the former president, Olusegun Obasanjo. And our reaction to that was included in our press release, where we said that his comment in putting ethno-religious motive to Boko Haram and ISWAP is deeply offensive and very, very divisive. And that we believe that such a statement, such a very innocent comment coming from a former president is very, very sad.
Do you think his concerns are legitimate, particularly when he is backed by some elders of the Christian Council of Nigeria?
There's absolutely no legitimacy in that comment, because if anybody cares to do a thorough analysis and does not just want to play to the gallery, he would realize that more Muslim lives have been lost to either Boko Haram or to the banditry in the Northwest. The facts are clear that more mosques have been razed down than churches. So where are the facts to support that kind of, you know, divisive statement? You see, whoever supports him, I think he must be doing so from an emotional viewpoint. The facts on ground do not support Islamization, colonization of Nigeria.
Mr. Mohammed, will the government engage some of these individuals who are expressing concern about what they describe as an attempt to Islamicize or Fulanicize Nigeria to address some of their concerns?
You see, the tragedy of the whole matter is that starting from former President Olusegun Obasanjo, these are individuals or groups who have access to the president, and who, if they were actually, you know, patriotic, and if they had no ulterior motives, could have engaged with the president about this concern. The president would have allayed their fears. And in addition, it's on record that the president is continuously, almost on a daily basis, engaging various sectors of society, various leadership, various people on the issues confronting Nigeria. So I think the former president's decision to make that kind of statement is quite sad. Even the fact that he has an unfair access to Mr. President.
So where is the fight against terrorism or insecurity in Nigeria at the moment? Because some of these people are citing this insecurity as part of the plot to Islamicize or Fulanicize Nigeria.
Well, if you ask the picture, when you talk about Fulanization or Islamization, I think we should just expand those rules from our lexicon. Because it's not possible in Nigeria in the first season. And the fact of the matter is not support it. It's unfortunate that a person of the state of the former president could make this kind of statement. It's not backed by any fact. It's not backed by anything. And everybody who has been commenting, unfortunately, they've been commenting rather from emotional viewpoint. I'm concerned only about the issue of feminization and Islamization. Yes, we admit we have security challenges, which we are overcoming. But for anybody, no matter how highly placed or any group, to actually, you know, say that this is colonization, that the government has a policy of colonization and transition of the diaspora, it's grossly unfair and very unpatriotic.
Lai Mohammed is the Nigerian Information Minister. He spoke with me from Abuja. The main opposition Sierra Leonean People's Party, or SLPP, rejected the invitation to participate in the Bintumani 3 conference. The SLPP argued that the conference, organized by the government as part of a peace and reconciliation effort, was unnecessary and a waste of taxpayers' money. The party says the government should instead resolve concerns opposition parties recently expressed at a meeting with President Julius Maada Bio. For reaction from the government over the main opposition party's boycott, I reach Mohammed Rahman Swari, the Sierra Leonean Information Minister.
Government is very disappointed, profoundly disappointed, that the APC squandered a historic opportunity to attend Bintumani 3 and contribute their views, their opinions, and their experiences to the establishment of a permanent national infrastructure for the enhancement of peace and achievement of national cohesion. You know, but the good news is, electoral unions from across the divide, from every nook and cranny, every corner of the country, you know, attended the conference at the very highest levels. This is indeed they have been with.
But Mohammed, the APC is of the view that Bintumani 1 and 2 occurred because Sierra Leone was at war at that time, and that it was necessary for both sides during the conflict to talk in order to resolve it. This time, Sierra Leone is in a democratic dispensation, they argue, and that this does not make sense since you have embraced the tenet of democracy. What say you?
Well, I mean, it's unfortunate that such PUL arguments are coming from the main opposition party. I mean, His Excellency the President, retired Brigadier General Osman Abiu, made it very clear. He paid glowing tributes to the resolve of several unions to solve their historic problems anytime they were confronted by one. He mentioned Bintumani 1, Bintumani 2, an opportunity which several unions used to best defend to talk about the democratic process and the future of their democracy. Similarly, this was about the consolidation of our democracy. This Bintumani 3 was not about the political ambitions and aspirations of one person. This was about Sierra Leoneans to talk about the consolidation of their democracy. So that is why I say it was a missed opportunity. It was squandered. Other political leaders who saw the need for it attended in full force. You had the NGC of Dr. Candace Oleyom Keller. You had various other political party leaders. In fact, you had Dr. Alpha Kanu, one of my predecessors in the Ministry of Information and Communications, not only in attendance, but also playing a key role, because he believes, and rightly so, that every Sierra Leonean, every patriotic Sierra Leonean must put Sierra Leone first, irrespective of any peripheral grudges or grievances he might have. And he was right.
But why will the government expect something from the APC when the APC is accusing the government of using state institutions, including police and the judiciary, to persecute them, to make the party unpopular, and to undermine its support in its stronghold areas? And that the government, through President Mada Bio, has made an effort to ensure that it loses support in its stronghold. How do you react to that?
Well, it's unfortunate. It's very, very unfortunate. President Mada Bio does not need to make extra efforts. He does not need to work overtime to ensure that the APC loses support. They lost support in the first instance. That is why President Bio won the election. You know, development knows no political parties. It knows no regions. President Bio has embarked on a nationwide rebuilding, you know, and renewal effort of our country. He has introduced a free quality education, which is being enjoyed in every part of the country.
The APC is accusing your government of attempting to use the judiciary to reduce its majority in parliament by first placing an injunction on 16 members of parliament from the APC and using brute force to remove the entire 68 elected members of parliament by ensuring that the Speaker of Parliament and the Deputy Speaker come from the minority SLPP party. Your take?
Those are loose allegations, Peter. I was in Parliament on the very day of the Speakership election. And the court injunction had been passed. So what the clerk did was to announce the names of persons who were affected by the injunction and advise them to leave the world. They insisted they would not leave, and their colleagues, who had nothing to do with court cases and injunctions, walked out in solidarity with them. Again, they squandered an opportunity to participate in the election of the Speaker as mandated by parliamentary processes and procedures. Talk about the ongoing petitions in court. President Bio has sworn to respect separation of powers and the rule of law.
Mohammed Rahman Sware is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital of Freetown.
St. Augustine's Power Students Union, or APSU, held a fundraising gala last night at Camelot in Maryland, a few miles outside Washington, D.C. Organizers say the event was meant to strengthen the bond between the old students and the school back home. Located in Cape Coast, Ghana, St. Augustine's College is the first secondary school established by the Catholic Church. Joining me live
is Augustine Abuchi, a key member of the organizer. Welcome, Augustine.
Thank you, Peter.
Now, let me ask you, what were your impressions of last night's event?
It was great. In fact, it was better than I expected. We had a full house. We had people come in showing a lot of support for our school. Our school is located in West Africa, Ghana to be specific, and we are all over the world. And so this year we decided to bring all Absunians in the U.S. together. So we met in Maryland, and then we came in and showed a lot of support and love for our school.
There was clearly a demonstration of camaraderie, a strong bond. People were remembering their time in school and so forth. But some people kept asking, can this be sustained? How sustainable is this?
Oh, absolutely. I think what one thing I learned from yesterday was that a lot of people were yearning to come together, but because of distance and geographical boundaries, people were not able to do so in the past. But now with social media, we always get interaction going, and they're keen on coming even for next year's program.
Well, next year, the school celebrates its 90th anniversary of existence in Ghana. What are some of the programs lined up, and what can the past students union, APSU to be specific, do to help in this effort?
Actually, we can do a lot. From next year, we launched our anniversary a few weeks ago, and then for the 90th anniversary, we're going to renovate the whole school, actually. One of the typical programs would be to renovate our school library and bring it up to state-of-the-art standards. And so the 95-year group, I know, for example, are doing a lot on that. Now, I know a couple of years ago, the 93-year group also did a solar project to bring the school off the national grid and to go in clean energy. And so we're putting all of those things in place, and we hope to achieve certain goals within the 90th anniversary. And one key thing is we want to bring about, we want to do the SDGs and that the UN adopted. We're adopting about probably four of them. We can do about 10, but we're focusing on four, and that will get us through the goals by 2030.
So let's look at some of the goals that you mentioned. They are specific, they are pragmatic, but how will this boost the school's performance, not only academically, but as a human being, as a human institution?
That's a great question. Actually, electricity is one of the biggest things we needed in our country. We have intermittent electric power, but solar power is going to give us constant power for students to be able to learn. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to extend it into sustainability so that, for example, when we have waste from our dining halls, for example, we want to compost it and use it to feed the school farms. We want to do like boreholes to irrigate the whole school to, you know, water the lawns and to bring it to some standard. After all, if when a human well-being is improved and environmental risks are reduced and, you know, ecological scarcity is reduced, it improves everybody's well-being. And that's one of the definitions of the long goals for the UN.
Now, talk about the lack of maintenance in institutions. We've known African governments to invest millions and millions of dollars in projects. Within a period of time, lack of maintenance set in, and before long, millions of dollars just go waste. What will be different this time?
This time we want to do a pragmatic approach, like you mentioned earlier on. For each project that we do, we want to set up a maintenance culture. We want to set up a maintenance blueprint so that for every project we accompany a maintenance blueprint, which will be monitored on a periodic basis. That way we don't let projects go to waste, or we don't let people slack off their jobs.
So let's talk about what these past students can do for the current students in terms of monitoring, in terms of engaging them periodically, in terms of boosting their morale and teaching them to think differently than the rigid way of thinking, and to bring them to par with their colleagues in other countries, particularly in the Western world. I mean, how will this be put in place in order to ensure that there's a smooth coordination between the students back home and the past students?
Actually, it begins by joining your year group. So we want all our folks to join their year groups. I belong to the 93-year group. A few of them, everybody knows their year group. So with the year group, we all come together as one, and every year group has their own projects that they do. Then as a national APSU USA, we also have a joint project that we would do. So when you join your groups at your level, you contribute that way, and then when we all come together as a national, we all contribute nationally. So we have one unit voice.
Augustine Abochi is a key member of the APSU organizing committee. He joined me live here at the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. FIFA has abandoned plans to expand the 2022 World Cup to 48 teams. FIFA President Gianni Infantino said last year the expansion from 32 teams could be brought forward from 2026 to the 2022 tournament in Qatar. The change would have required Qatar to share hosting duties with other countries in the region. FIFA said after a thorough and comprehensive consultation process, the change could not be made now. FIFA also said it explored the possibility of Qatar hosting a 48-team tournament on its own, but has decided not to pursue those plans as there was not enough time for a detailed assessment of the potential logistical impact. In November, UEFA said adding 16 teams to Qatar 2022 could create many problems and described the idea as quite unrealistic. Still in football, former South African Football Association president Chabu Gok Alei has been banned from all football-related activities for 10 years for misappropriation of funds and bribery, according to FIFA. Along with the ban, which comes into immediate effect, Alei was also fined $500,000 Swiss francs. FIFA said in a statement that Chabu Gok Alei had been found guilty of having misappropriated FIFA funds, as well as having offered gifts or benefits in violation of the FIFA Code of Ethics. Alei is also a former FIFA Standing Committee member. FIFA says the ruling was related to the misappropriation of FIFA Financial Assistance Program and FIFA Goal Program funds received by South Sudan Football Association during the 2014 and 2015 period, and to payments made to football officials and other individuals. And in athletics, the former head of Kenya's track and field team has also been banned from athletics for 10 years. The IAAF ethics panel found Major Michael Rotich agreed to give advance notice of drug tests to athletes and coaches for financial gain. It said the purpose of the agreement was to assist those athletes to flush their systems of banned substances before taking doping tests. Rotich managed the Kenyan athletics team at the 2016 Olympics in Rio. The allegations arose from an investigation by the Sunday Times and the German broadcaster ARD on the eve of the Rio Games, when they secretly filmed Rotich apparently making an offer to provide prior warning of drug tests in return for £10,000. He said he was only going along with it because he wanted to find out who the undercover reporters were and protect athletes. But the story led him to being sent home from Rio and triggered investigations by the IAAF Athletics World Governing Body and anti-doping agents of Kenya, along with Rotich's suspension. Meanwhile, Bahrain's Olympic women's marathon silver medalist Eunice Kirwa has been provisionally suspended after failing a doping test. Kirwa, who switched allegiance from Kenya in 2013, tested positive for EPO, a banned blood-boosting hormone that improves endurance. That's according to a statement by the Athletics Integrity Unit, AIU. Kenyan Jamina Samgong, a gold medalist, was suspended in 2017 for using the same substance, but was allowed to keep her medal as she tested positive in April 2017. Finally, Caster Semenya will race in the 3,000 meters at the Diamond League Prefontein Classic on June 30th, a distance she can compete at without having to lower her testosterone levels. Under new IAAF rules, the double 800 meters Olympic champion can run in events from 400 meters to a mile by taking medication. The 28-year-old South African has said she will not take medication to comply with the rules. The race will be her first since the rules came into effect on May 8th. Women with higher than normal male hormone levels, the so-called hyperandrogenic athletes, will now artificially reduce the amount of testosterone in their bodies to be allowed to compete in races between 400 meters and a mile. Semenya won 800 meters at the Doha Diamond League meeting on May 3rd, her first race since losing her appeal against the controversial rule change at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Semenya will be an underdog in a stellar field that is expected to include World 5,000 meters champion Helen Obiri, 2016 World Indoor 1,500 meter champion Sifan Hassan, and 2018 World Indoor 1,500 meters and 3,000 meters champion Genzebe Dibaba. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sport Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you are hearing from Tubaba featuring Salty Soul, Oyakam Make We Go, and then Emmanuel featuring Davido Elele. K-Man, Fall In Love follows, and then we have Mao Sama with Katu Katu.
Circle of life, but I am an example. I know that you can make it in this life. If only you try to stand up and pick up your chest. Don't let nobody tell you, make yourself to for less. Whenever you afraid, just so my head. Shop, shop, show, make we holler, let it go. Oh, yeah, come, make we go. Make we go to all the best. So we talk, so we would like to go before. Make we go, make we see. But you let them do for you. A two-step and what next? A life to remember. Eti umekwama. No, ni kama kusema kwamba ulivyo ungwa na mola ya ni ulivyo simama. Sana, sana, uwezi kufanya. If you don't try, you don't get. And if you don't go, then you never ever know, no. If you don't jump, you never fly. And if you don't fall, then you never feel the pain, girl. Time is a healer. Pain is a teacher. Stress reliever, be a believer. Where come, let me go. Let me go to all the places. So we talk, so we would like to go before. Let me go, let me see. But you know, let me for real. Let me feel, let me check. I'm not too high, never used to we go low. But now after we go, we go low. Better not true, but better not like it, let me go. Where come, let me go. Where come, let me go. Where come, let me go. I'm not too high, I'm not used to we go low. That's how we live.
I don't fall in love. See, I don't fall in love. I believe in you, and day we do anything we elect for do. Why are you changed?
I don't know.
Baby, now forgive me. king and the new year queen. Your love na me had to make him and sing. Let me explain, the beautiful is for cavalis. The best na me boy, you never the least. Pretty face, the eyeball just to kill me. I hope you could give me chance to feel me. Sentimental touching, midnight hugging. Give me the seal for make up all in love. Brown skin, you put it taste like ice cream. Want you for be my wife in a me dream. This love go tight like paper and glue. For play the game like chess and pool. I'm fly, but baby the why eats me alive. You don't wanna choose it, baby I will die, come on.
Now you show me the world, now you make her breathe. Now you make her know the difference between love and hate. You get the key to me heart, you the bring smile on my face. Anytime I see you pretty face, me heart the cold. You show me the things one by one they see, one they see. Truly, now you make her begin fall.
Been say me really love you. Over me body, me want me to take you. Never vex when it come to sex. Express me love in night and day. Remember when we cooked up in a Facebook. When they tell me say you got a body pretty in a loose. Me gave you number and they call me too. Me proud to be calling me baby boo. Oops. Things are not really matter. That's why me call you me, I'm in a tar. Because never puffy make a love scatter. When they say you really mean it and you never flatter. Baby, come close. Take me touch and take off your clothes. Yeah. If your ex burn, I give you all night. Skill of us are ready, we can make you feel alright.
Yeah. And now I know true love exists. Without you, now my life, the world's so useless. You love me, medicine. If I take you out of well, I'm sorry, babe, for all the things I do to you. You show me the things one by one they see. One they see.
Yeah.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. For decades after decades, a large number of thoughtful Africans have marveled at the oddity of outsiders, mainly from the Western world, coming to the African continent to tell Africa what will be good for them. They often do this ignoring African culture, mores, and tradition. During the colonial period, which lasted centuries, the harbinger or the bearer of the message were missionaries who were trying to save the world for Jesus in their generation. Nowadays, however, the messengers are NGOs, non-governmental organizations who are convinced of their conviction, and they are now roaming the African continent to tell Africans what they should or should not do on social issues. By the way, on social issues which have only just evolved in their own country, but which they now want to push in Africa for immediate adoption. Quite often, Africans are in a bind. In the colonial period, they had no choice. After independence and in the range of dependency, they often have to follow advice coming from abroad. And often they could not resist the pressure that is applied on them to make changes in political, social, and economic policies. Two events last week, however, may represent harbinger for the future reaction of African people. In Kenya, the High Court panel of three judges unanimously rejected an appeal by a campaign group trying to determine that the Kenyan constitution has been violated by all colonial rule banning same-sex relationship. The court said that while the colonial laws may not be in accordance with those trying to change it, they are in conformity with Kenyan customs and moral code, and therefore rejected the appeal and saying that the laws stand. Of course, the usual crowd have come out to criticize the Kenyan court ruling, but it will pay much for them to listen to the views of Kenyans and other Africans who may have some difficulties on this troubling issue, bearing in mind that even in their own country abroad, there are many of the compatriots who do have difficulties embracing same-sex relationship. The other event was in Botswana. Botswana has been concerned with the large number of elephants in the country. According to the government, they have 150,000 elephants now in Botswana. And the government believes that these elephants are now becoming a menace to the Botswanan farmers and causing great harm in the country. But Botswana was up against a very powerful conservation group which hails from abroad, who believe that the elephants should be allowed to roam in Botswana and that the government should do nothing that will reduce the number of elephants in Botswana. So the government of Botswana played a very clever diplomatic game. It first lobbied African countries in its neighborhood and obtained a consensus of its plan. Its plan is to allow regulated hunting of elephants to keep the number of elephants in check. And when the international conservation group raised alarm, the government said that that group should know that Botswana officials are not reckless and they would take care of the elephants. And it now seems that the government of Botswana will proceed with their plan. These two events are important because it shows that Africans should be determined to shape their own opinion and old farm, because those who come from abroad to teach them lessons will not tolerate Africans to go to their country to tell them what and what they should not do in terms of their traditions and mores. That is why these two events may be a landmark, and Africans should pay attention to what happened last week in Kenya and Botswana with respect to same-sex relationship and the conservation of elephants. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Xiao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you cannot roast corn with two eyes. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.